I hope you enjoy this talk. These talks are always offered freely so that no one is ever denied access to these teachings, and your support really makes a big difference. Dana is the ancient Pali word for spontaneous generosity of heart. If you feel inspired to support these talks by offering Dana, you can do so by visiting my website at www.mindfulvalley.com. Thank you so much. So, the Satipatthana Sutta. I love the way that sounds. Satipatthana Sutta. It has been described as, quote, the most important discourse ever given by the Buddha. And he tells us this. There is monks, which means us. There is monks, a direct path that leads to the purification of beings, to the overcoming of sorrow and distress, to the disappearance of pain and sadness, to the gaining of the right method, to the realization of nirvana, that is to say, the four foundations of mindfulness. So obviously this is, you know, these four are really important to know. And this sutta is so essential, actually, that it is often been called the direct path leading to nirvana. The direct path. And because it is essentially our main instructions manual for the practice, its teachings are central to every Buddhist tradition throughout the world. So even though all the different traditions have varying beliefs and trainings now, it's been thousands of years, these instructions have remained a kind of unifying thread. You know, these are the instructions, which means that this sutta is really, it's meant for anyone and everyone who wants to practice the path of meditation to deepen their spiritual search. This is it, okay? In fact, when the Buddha first gave this sutta or sermon about 2,600 years ago, he didn't offer it in a monastery only for the monastics. He delivered it in a village filled with people just like you and me who were interested in what he had to say. Okay. And what he suggested was that it doesn't matter if you're just starting out on the path of meditation, or you're just interested in what meditation has to offer, or maybe if you want to become a teacher or a monk or a nun or maybe even an arahant. He said that everyone who practices, everyone, quote, should be exhorted, settled, and established in the development of these four foundations of mindfulness, or what in the original Pali language is called the four Satipatthanas, okay? And again, because this is truly our entire practice, these series of talks are only going to be a slim summary, sadly, or outline of these four, but hopefully it will provide us with a base for deepening our understanding. That's my hope. And as we begin, it will be helpful to keep in mind that in Pali, the word sati, S-A-T-I, means mindfulness, right? Which is often translated as to remember or recall. Sati, to remember or recall. And patana in Pali means origin or starting point. And so thousands of years ago, as the Buddha was offering the sutta, he was essentially saying that there are four important things for us to constantly keep in mind and remember, these four Satipatthanas, these foundations, where our practice or path originates, okay? And so as you might imagine, when the Buddha first began his talk about the Satipatthanas, he was asked, what four? And here I'd like to read you his answer directly from the sutta, because I want you to hear what is called the refrain, which is repeated throughout It's vitally important to our understanding and practice to understand this refrain, okay? And you'll hear it. And the Buddha said this, "Come, friends, dwell contemplating body in the body, diligently, clearly knowing and mindful, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. Dwell contemplating feelings in feelings, diligent, clearly knowing and mindful, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. Dwell contemplating mind in mind, diligent, clearly knowing and mindful, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. Dwell contemplating Dharma in Dharmas, diligent, clearly knowing, mindful, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world." So to summarize, the Buddha is asking us to be mindful of these four things or categories, really categories, the body, feelings, mind, and dharmas, diligently, clearly knowing, mindful, free from desire and discontent in regard to the world. I'm saying this over and over so you'll hopefully remember it, memorize it. Remember it, be mindful of it. And this refrain was actually repeated over and over because, again, these are the things we are asked to constantly keep in mind as we practice. They're truly essential for any growth or transformation in our practice, actually. So having said that, because this is how we are being asked to practice, this means not perfectly, right? It's a practice. And honestly, this might be the most important thing, that we are extremely kind and patient with ourselves as we go through this, right? You might even recall that metta, unconditional friendliness, is the foundation or ground of our practice. So we want to plant our whole practice. We want to plant it in the soil of kindness. Okay? It's the most important thing. We also don't want to strive here, which is antithetical to our practice and our growth, right? So for instance, we don't plant a seed in the soil and then keep pulling it up by the roots to check on them, right? That doesn't work. We patiently water our practice and kindly allow it to unfold. That's how we practice. You might even recall that the Buddha's teachings themselves are called the middle way because they involve a balanced approach, right, to our practice, a balanced energy, not too tight, not too loose. It's a very common phrase in the Buddhist practice, not too tight, not too loose. And the word I often like to remember is the word gentle. I love that word, gentle, because it implies both kindness and patience, a light touch, and a kind of continuation, right? Gentle. We're not giving up, and we're not running ahead of ourselves either. Gentle. I like to also think of walking barefooted along a path. And along the way, there are rocks and other things that we want to avoid stepping on, right? And so courageously, we continue walking along this path, which is going to have rocks in it, maybe some snakes, maybe some spiders, whatever. What did you, with skunks? Yeah, skunks. I don't know, right? But we do it gently. Gently, we're not running ahead, right? We keep walking. Another metaphor that I like to think of is a kind, compassionate school teacher who's trying to keep her students attentive, right? Keep them in the present. You know, they might be staring out the window or drawing in their notebooks. And so very kindly and gently, she needs to keep reminding them to come back into the present, to pay attention, pay attention. Pay attention, not in a harsh way, right? Not in a, pay attention, not in that way. Pay attention, kind, balanced. So she's diligent about this. So if our students, if you will, only paid attention every once in a while, they're not going to learn a lot, right? Same with our practice. If we only give it a little bit of attention, We're not going to get very far. So we are diligent in using our mindfulness, sati, which along with remembering means to know experience through our bare attention. So this is an attention or awareness that is non-judgmental. It's free from opinion. It's simply aware of what's happening. Okay? So this kind of mindfulness has often been described as a kind of mirror. You know, it simply observes and reflects what's happening. There is no me in it. There's no personality or self in bare awareness. Okay? So if you'll recall from the refrain, the Buddha asks us to contemplate body in the body, feelings in the feelings, mind in the mind, dhammas in dhammas. And the language is very precise here for a reason. Okay? When we practice, we are not being asked to approach experience as a disconnected self, but as awareness itself, witnessing the dance of experience from within it. Okay? The Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh describes it this way. Contemplating body in the body means that you do not stand outside of something to contemplate it. You must be one with it, with no distinction between the contemplator and the contemplated. Contemplating body in the body means that you should not look on your body as the object of your contemplation. You have to be one with it. You have to be one with it. Which can be hard. You know, but that's what the practice is asking us to try to do. In a very similar way, we are being asked to practice with clear knowing. And the Pali word for this is sampajana. Sampajana, clear knowing. And its core meaning is to see the arising and passing of all phenomena for what it is, which is impermanent, not permanently satisfying, and most importantly, not me or mine. Okay, you guys still with me? Yeah. So many of you may recognize these as the three characteristics or truth of existence, right? So the truth that because all things are impermanent, anicca, including ourselves, anatta, no self, we experience suffering, frustration, disappointment, things being not permanently satisfying. Is there anything in your life that you can think of that's permanently satisfying? Think about that this week. Just check it out. Permanently satisfying. So with clear knowing, sapajana, especially, we are being asked to let go of a sense of a solid, permanent, never-changing self, which is, of course, the part of the practice that is the most misunderstood and the most difficult, and it's also the most rewarding and liberating part of our practice. Okay? It's what we're aiming at, which is why it's difficult to understand in the beginning, because that's what we're kind of aiming at. It takes a while. But as the teachings show us, this strong sense of self is actually what creates our deepest source of suffering, because it involves this seemingly constant, never-ending struggle to prop up or inflate or defend a sense of self. God, aren't we doing that all day? You might even be doing it right now, right? It's just constant. And so when we can use our practice to investigate this more closely, honestly, what we begin to see is that this constant battle only helps to fuel our feeling and our sense of feeling separate. And of course, our feeling of feeling separate leads to even more suffering, which is, of course, it's just a vicious cycle. We're constantly struggling to not feel separate, but the struggle is what's causing us to feel separate, right? Start noticing that. That can be fascinating. And honestly, this is an aspect of the practice that I think is vitally missing in some of the more modern training that's out there right now. Mindfulness is so popular. Paul brought me 2 magazines just this month, the last 2 weeks, National Geographic and Time. And they're both all about mindfulness practice, right? But if we're not aware of this aspect of our practice, anatta, impermanence, it can actually start to reinforce a sense of ego, which is the very opposite of what we're trying to achieve, right? So be on the lookout for that when you're reinforcing a sense of ego in some way through our practice, and drop it, you know? The Buddha's instructions are very clear on this. He asks us to practice diligently, mindfully, clearly knowing, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. And so that last part of the refrain, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world, acts as kind of a reminder of the first three. Acts as a reminder. So it's asking us to practice not clinging to anything, right? Not pushing anything away, but to rest right here in awareness itself, right in the center of our wanting and not wanting, wanting and not wanting. Rest in the center, okay, in the present moment. Remembering again that all things, including ourselves, are in constant flow and motion, constantly changing, inevitably will no longer exist. Even the sun and the moon at some point will disintegrate, won't be here at some point. And this understanding of constant change is what eventually leads us to a more sustained equanimity or balanced awareness, which is considered the fruit of our practice. Okay. So many of you know this already, but one of my teachers, Bhikkhu Anayu, who's considered one of the preeminent scholars on the Satipatthana Sutta, has written many books on the Satipatthana Sutta, if anybody really wants to dig deeper and get more scholarly and technical about it. Even though he's written all these dense, very dense scholarly books, what I remember the most from him is 4 simple words, which is somebody maybe a bumper sticker, because you guys, I use this so often. But this is the summary of the whole practice, right? Keep calmly knowing change. That's it. Right? Keep calmly knowing change. And I think of those 4 words as just an easy way to remember the refrain or the directions that we're supposed to follow and practice. So keep diligently, ardently, keep calmly, without grasping, pushing away, without the endless struggle, knowing, being mindful of, having a clear awareness of change, the truth of impermanence. Diligently, clearly knowing, mindful, free from desire, and content in regard to the world. Pretty simple, right? Piece of cake. So now that we have the basic instructions, how do we start? Where do we begin? So as you might imagine, we start at home, right? By becoming mindful of this first satipatthana, which is the body. Because this is where we live, our spiritual home, which means it's actually where everything lives. And the Buddha from the Satipatthana Sutta says this: there is one thing that, when cultivated and regularly practiced, leads to deeper spiritual intention, to peace, to mindfulness and clear comprehension, to vision and knowledge, to a happy life here and now, and to the culmination of wisdom and awakening. And what is that one thing? It is mindfulness centered on the body. Right? Mindfulness centered on the body. And if you think about it, we experience the whole of our existence, everything, through this body. through all our five senses, and of course the sixth sense, which is the mind. It's considered the sixth sense. Everything, right? We cannot not do this, right? We can only experience life through this vessel, this body. You know, the teacher John Kabat-Zinn tells us, wherever you go, there you are. Wherever you go, there you are. In the Anguttara Nikaya, the Buddha famously tells us, I declare that it is in this fathom-long body with its perceptions and thoughts that there is the world. I declare that it is in this fathom-long body with its perceptions and thoughts that there is the world. Right? So true. And so often when people think of meditation, they assume that the emphasis is on the mind. But again, the mind and the body aren't separate. They're connected. This is very much an embodied practice. It's not an out-of-body practice where we go somewhere else. Kelgon, take me away. You know? It's not that. In fact, when we're less aware of our bodies, what we're doing is living in the mind instead of being present, which is often living in the past, isn't it? In the mind, we're in the past or we're in the future. And both are dream states. They don't exist. They're fantasies, right? They don't exist how we think they exist, right? We can all make up stuff about the past however we want to, really, how we make it up. Future doesn't exist. That's a fantasy. And so the body can only ever be here in the present moment, right? And if we really listen to it, if we know it and listen to it, it speaks. And it will tell us the truth, always. The mind won't. Mind usually lies to us. But we go to it first for some weird reason, right? A lot of people will tell me that, and this happened on retreat last week, that the feel like they're practicing well when they've achieved a blank state of mind, when they've gone away somewhere, and then they come back when the bell rings. They come back, they've been away. And sadly, what I tell them is that this kind of going away is not helping us to achieve a lot of transformation or awakening, because it's keeping us from experiencing the fullness of our bodies. And therefore, our entire lives, right? It's also, when we're away from the body, not helping us to explore or see into the nature of the mind so that we can work with it. Going away is not at all helpful, okay? Really want to make that clear. Which is why we are asked to pay attention to and really get to know the body, the first foundation, diligently, mindfully, clearly knowing, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. And the Buddha gives us very specific instructions for how to do this, starting by telling us exactly where to do this and how. So just a show of hands, how many of you have read this sutta? Okay, good. Couple, yeah. So in the sutta, he tells us that we should, quote, go to the forest, to the foot of a tree, or to an empty room, sit down cross-legged in the lotus position, hold one's body straight, and establish mindfulness in front of us. Okay, so I'm going to go through this a little bit. So now when he says in front of us, he's not literally saying being mindful of something that's literally in front of us. What he's saying is he's asking us to stay in the present moment, right now, by paying attention to what's right here in front of us, this present moment, what's here right now, right? Not in the past or the future, moment by moment by moment, right? Because when I started this talk, that's already gone. That's the past, this moment. He's also strongly encouraging us to find a quiet space to meditate, because this can calm the mind and the body, which can help us achieve a better concentration. And both calm and concentration are essential to our practice. So this is the shamatha, or the calming concentration aspect of the teaching. So the full name for what we're doing, insight meditation, is shamatha vipassana. Okay? The shamatha part is the concentration aspect. Vipassana is insight. So it's shamatha vipassana. And we need the shamatha for the development, or bhavana, it's called bhavana, development, of our insight vipassana practice. Okay? So if we're just starting out, especially, it's going to be really difficult or take a lot of time or take a lot longer to achieve a sense of calm and concentration, shamatha, if we're practicing in an atmosphere that is loud or busy or distracting. We can still do it. You know, it can be done, and it's actually kind of good practice sometimes to try to meditate in a busy situation. But when you're just starting, really difficult, which is one of the reasons the practice of noble silence that we have here, and on retreat especially, is so crucial, because you want to get that sense of calm and concentration. It's essential for the development, bhavana, of our insight. Okay? So the Buddha is also asking us to sit upright in a way that involves a balance of attention and effort and relaxation, right? So this can be really tricky. Again, it's that sense of not too tight, not too loose. We want to have both relaxation and alertness. We also don't want to strive too much, and you know, we also don't want to be kind of lounging around, just kind of lying down and sleeping. Okay? So we want to find a good balance. And the best posture for this kind of balance is actually the full-blown cross-legged lotus position. It's considered ideal for finding this kind of balance. But in our modern Western culture, very few of us can actually do this. Okay, right? Just a few weeks ago, Charlotte and Elaine were both there with me. I led a 5-day retreat with one of my teachers, Pat Coffey. He's a 70-year-old guy. He's in great shape. And I was so humbled by the fact that he can really sit that way. He sat that way the whole retreat, right? And he's trained himself to do this over many, many years. You know, in his 20s, he lived in an ashram. You know, they trained him how to do this. So his body has been trained to do that. But for the rest of us mere mortals, we simply practice by trying to keep our bodies as still and as comfortable as possible, right? Even in our chairs. So for me, I'm really uncomfortable on a chair. I have to sit cross-legged. My legs are short. I don't like sitting in a chair. This bench that I use here is the most comfortable for me, and it keeps my posture in the best position when I'm sitting, okay? And more still. So find that for yourself, right? Find that balance. Once we become calm and quiet, we then start to become mindful of something that is the easiest for most of us to directly observe within this home of ours, the body, something that offers us a constant, never-ending flow of change that we can use our mindfulness to concentrate on, and something that connects us to everything, to all of life, and that's the breath, right? And again, the way we practice is this way, and I'll read this to you from the sutta. One breathes in, aware that one is breathing in. One breathes out, aware that one is breathing out. When one breathes in a long breath, one knows, I am breathing in a long breath. When one breathes out a long breath, one knows, I am breathing out a long breath. When one breathes in a short breath, one knows, I am breathing in a short breath. When one breathes in out a short breath, one knows, I am breathing out a short breath. Breathing in, I am aware of my whole body. Breathing out, I am aware of my whole body. Breathing in, I calm my body. Breathing out, I calm my body. Okay. These are specific instructions. We're really intimate with the act of breathing. Okay. And we're being asked to do that so that we can very experientially become aware of the breath and its impermanent nature, and how it too is constantly moving and changing. We also want to become more and more aware of how it connects us to all things and truly experience that we're not separate from everything around us. Right? We can do that just with the breath, just by being mindful of the breath. What I also love about paying attention to the breath is that it helps us to learn to let go, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. As a for instance, we can control the breath if we want to, can't we? We can control the breath. But eventually, we begin to understand through our practice that it's so much easier to allow it and simply experience the breath rather than trying to control it, which is, of course, how we are learning how to live our lives. So just this breath practice can show us that and teach us how to let go. And letting go, in, there's so much freedom in that. You might be starting to see a theme here, yes? Yeah, I hope. And of course, because the breath is also connected to consciousness and to the way we live our lives, simply being mindful of our breath takes a lot of practice, doesn't it? Everybody? Yeah. So because of this, we're very gentle, again, with ourselves, and we're patient. Because as we all know, just this quote-unquote simple practice of being mindful of our breath can be incredibly difficult. It might also be helpful to know that the practice of being mindful of the breath is something that we continue to use throughout the course of our lives. It's not something that we need to move on from or graduate from to some more complicated or complex practice, right? In fact, 20 years after the Buddha became enlightened, his personal attendant Ananda asked him, "Venerable Sir, if people ask me whether you are still practicing meditation, what should I tell them?" And the Buddha said, yes, he was still meditating. And he said, "Venerable Sir, what kind of meditation should I tell them that you practice?" And he said, "Tell them I practice mindfulness of breathing." Mindfulness of breathing. Okay. This is 20 years after he became enlightened. We never let that go. Along with the breath, this sutta also asks us to become aware of body as a whole and all of its different postures, which are also constantly moving and changing. You know, you've probably shifted many times during this talk. It's constantly moving, right? It's hard to sit still. And here again, I'll read from the sutta. And by the way, throughout these talks, please, I'm going to try to change the gender whenever I can. When a practitioner walks, she is aware, I am walking. When he is standing, he is aware, I am standing. When she's sitting, she's aware, I am sitting. When he's lying down, he is aware, I am lying down. In whatever position his body happens to be, one is aware of the position of one's body. So this might seem very obvious or simple, but again, as a practice, we might start to notice how often we are actually not aware of, not living in our bodies, but using them simply as vessels on which to carry the mind, right? Whenever we are lost in our thinking mind, caught up in self, you might notice that we're almost always completely unaware of the body, right? You're caught up in thinking, start to notice that. Where's the body? We're living in the past or the future, or maybe just caught up in whatever movie or drama is occupying the mind at the moment, and we lose touch with the body, right? So this is why our practice of being mindful of body in the body includes what are called the four formal postures. And many of you who've taken my MBSR workshop know these because we did them. Includes sitting meditation, which we did here, which is the most common. But there's also walking and standing, which we've all done tonight. And there's lying down meditation, the body scan, right? Which are all considered formal practices. There's a specific way that we do these. And again, I taught MBSR, many of you took those, for about 7 years. And I taught all four of these formal postures, including gentle yoga, because they're so helpful for really helping us to learn how to experience being in the body, body in the body, aware of the body in the body. Okay. So with this first foundation, mindfulness of the body, we proceed from the contemplation of the breath to our postures, and then we are asked to contemplate what are called the four great elements, Mahabhuta, earth, air, fire, and water, sometimes even the stars and consciousness itself, and again, experience ourselves as not only constantly changing, but a part of everything. That's why the elements are so important, remembering that we are that. I personally love the elements practice. It's so much a part of my personal private practice. Not only because it helps me to let go of a strong concept of self, but to experience a strong sense of connection to all things, everyone, which can actually feel incredibly blissful and liberating sometimes, to just feel that like complete connection to all things. Elements can help us with that. And I did offer some of the element practices in the MBSR workshop. Some of you might remember the mountain meditation or the lake meditation. Those are the elements meditations along with equanimity practice. And most people seem to really enjoy those. But what I didn't get into as much in the MBSR classes, the more secular classes, mostly because it would freak some people out, is the continuation of the teachings, which involves contemplating the three truths or characteristics again of the body, which is remembering that it's impermanent, anicca, not permanently satisfying, dukkha, right? Dukkha, dukkha, dukkha. Don't you wish the body was just permanently satisfied, be happy, even going to bed sometimes, right? Constantly flipping to find that comfortable, it's just never satisfying. So impermanent, not permanently satisfying, dukkha, and not self, anatta. Those are the three truths. And this part of the practice involves contemplating the body made up of parts that are not us, right? Just like in the suttas, it's described as a chariot is made up of parts that are not chariot. Or in today's modern world, you might think of cars. You know, if you take a pipe out of a car, is it still the car? Or is it just now a part? Is it car? You know, not really. So the Satipatthana actually gets really specific here and asks us to contemplate 32 parts of the body. And when I studied this with Bhikkhu Nayo, he set out all these very graphic anatomy books all over the lobby so we could look at them. They're very graphic. The sutta describes this part of the practice this way. I'm going to read it from the sutta. Bhikkhus, imagine a sack which can be opened at both ends, containing a variety of grains, brown rice, wild rice, mung beans, kidney beans, sesame, white rice. When someone with good eyesight opens the bag, he will review it like this. This is brown rice. This is wild rice. These are mung beans. These are kidney beans. These are sesame seeds. This is white rice. just so the practitioner passes in review of the whole of one's body, from the soles of one's feet to the hair on the top of the head, a body enclosed in a layer of skin and full of all the impurities which belong the body. Here is the hair of the head, the hairs on the body, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, bowels, excrement, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, saliva, mucus, fluid, urine. Yeah. I did not offer that in the MBSR workshops. So it's actually designed this way to help us to let go of our clinging and see the body as it really is, not how we want to perceive it. Not how we want to perceive it. And as you might imagine, this process naturally leads to contemplating the eventual sickness, aging, and death of the body, you know, which I definitely didn't want to teach in the workshops. It's hard. And this can seem like a really morbid or downer part of our practice, right? But it's meant to teach us how to live with less fear and more ease and freedom. It's meant to wake us up to this precious, fleeting life and experience it fully and not dream it away, right? By being awake to it all, awake to the body, and to not be so fearful of our eventual and very natural demise that we miss out on the joy of our lives. Wake up. This is it, right? We don't know if we have another. Buddhists think we do, but we don't know, right? Nobody knows. Because we're not dead Buddhists yet. Right? So the Sutta offers us many ways to contemplate this, and I want to just mention these really briefly. Okay. So the first and maybe less difficult practice is to use the breath. And remember, with each inhale, I'm so grateful for this breath. And this breath could be my last. I'm so grateful for this breath. This breath could be my last. The whole practice, you could do that for an hour, right? Part of the practice. The deeper practices, that's the more less difficult one, the deeper practices ask us to contemplate our own bodies decaying and changing, and even imagine our skeletons turning to dust and blowing away in the wind. Okay? And I personally kind of, when I did this practice for a couple weeks, I used this one a lot, and I really, it felt liberating in some way to imagine the skeleton just kind of blowing away in the wind finally. And when I studied with Bhikkhu and Al Yogini, he had a skeleton up on the stage behind him so we could really look at this and just visualize it. And on another retreat that I was on, a monk showed us this fast motion film that had a wolf that had died. And the time lapse was over many, many months. And it was so cool. It appeared like the wolf was just simply, if you can imagine, really fast. It was disappearing into the earth and becoming a part of the earth. It was actually incredibly beautiful, you know. I think there were several of these kind of animals that you could kind of watch that happened. It was a disappearing. But it wasn't really a disappearing because it seemed to be going back into the earth, right? Becoming something else. In many Asian countries, many Buddhists still practice going out to the charnel grounds to sit with the bodies that are decaying, with all the smells and the maggots, all of it. And it's considered a very deep and powerful way to help us let go of our fear of death. Okay? And so as we practice this way, being mindful of body in the body, we eventually start to know more and more experientially that the body, again, is impermanent, unsatisfactory, and selfless, not self. And when this happens, in the Buddha's words, we will, quote, know the body as it really is. We will know the body as it really is. And so as we go along in these next couple of months where I'll be offering these talks, I'm going to dive a little deeper into all of these characteristics. But tonight, as we end, maybe as an encouragement, I want to mention that even though we're asked to practice all four of the satipatthanas, mindfulness of body, feelings, mind, and dharmas, it is said that practicing just one can lead us to enlightenment, mainly because it includes and contains all the rest. So in the Anapanasamyutta, the Buddha compares the four satipatthanas to chariots that are coming from different directions, each driving through and scattering a heap of dust that is in the center of the crossroads, if you can imagine that. And this dust represents our delusion, which over time can be scattered by just one. But if we practice all four together, you might imagine we're going to have a much better chance of scattering that dust even faster and further. Okay? So hopefully that's encouragement for everybody. All right, so let's end with just a very brief contemplation. And so here I'm going to invite you to breathe in, breathe out. With that sense of breathing in, I know I'm breathing in. I'm breathing out, I'm breathing out. Just notice the quality of the breath. Maybe it's short or long, and shallow, deep. Know this. Be aware of this. Aware of body in the body. Thich Nhat Hanh tells us breath is the bridge which connects life to consciousness, which unites your body to your thoughts. Whenever your mind becomes scattered, use your breath as the means to take hold of your mind again. Use the breath to take hold of the mind again. Finally, just listening to these words from Donna Falls. I breathe in all that is, awareness expanding. To take everything in is if my heart beats the world into being. From the unnamed vastness beneath the mind, I breathe my way to wholeness and healing. Inhalation, exhalation, each breath a yes and a letting go, a journey and a coming home.